Senator Patterson.
Thank you, Madam President. My question is to the Minister representing the Prime Minister, Senator Wong. Minister, you said in question time yesterday, as people are being released, visa conditions are being applied to bridging visas for those people. Do you stand by this statement?
Minister Wong.
As I understand it, and I will just see where this is the case.
Minister Wong, please resume a seat. Senator Patterson.
Sorry, Madam President, let me correct that to benefit Senator Wong. I've not correctly ascribed that quote to you. Your quote was, in question time yesterday, individuals required to be released as a result of this decision by the High Court have been subject to a range of strict and mandatory visa conditions. My apologies.
Thank you, Senator Patterson. Minister Wong.
I understand. I'm advised that I'm just trying to say, I've been told page 3. All individuals who have been released as a result of the High Court's decision have been granted bridging removal pending visas with appropriate conditions, and law enforcement agencies have been notified of their release. I'm not sure if that is precisely what the Senator is referring to, but that's the advice I have. I have seen some of the media reports, and obviously these are decisions which have to be made reflecting the High Court decision, the need to release, notwithstanding the government's different submissions to the High Court, and the framework around the Minister's consideration of the application of the visa and its conditions.
Senator Patterson, first supplementary.
Minister, the ABC has reported today, and I quote, some of the detainees released from immigration detention were sent into the community without visas, a revelation that appears to contradict what the federal government has said in recent days. Have people been released into the community without visas or, as you have told this chamber, were they released on visas with strict conditions?
Minister Wong.
Senator, if I can, I will take on notice to get from Minister Giles a better explanation to you. I understand that there is a technical requirement to release and then for the visa conditions to be imposed, but let me provide obtain more clearer advice from the Minister and respond to you.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Patterson, second supplementary.
Thank you, Madam President. If visas have now been granted to these people, what are the consequences if they breach the conditions of those visas? Is it the case that breaching a visa requires that they be detained pending deportation, which the High Court has ruled is not applicable for this cohort?
Thank you, Senator Patterson. Minister Wong.
I think I was asked a similar question yesterday, might have been from Senator Cash or someone else, about the impact of or legal remedies available to government in the circumstances where visa conditions are breached or are not met. I am advised that this is one of the consequences of this decision of the High Court, and I can indicate to the Chamber that the government intends to introduce legislation shortly to further respond to the decision of the High Court, and we look forward to the opposition's support in that regard.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Walsh.
Thank you, President. My question is to the Minister representing the Treasurer, Senator Gallagher. Under the Albanese government, today's wage price index has recorded the highest quarterly increase in its 26-year history, along with an upward revision to wage growth in the previous quarter. Can the Minister explain how the Albanese government has supported getting wages moving again?
Minister Gallagher.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Walsh, and I acknowledge your long career in ensuring particularly those on lower incomes get appropriate wage increases for the work that they do, the important work that they do. We said we'd get wages moving again, and we are. Under this government, wages are growing at their fastest rate in a decade. Today's data show that the wage price index rose 1.3% in the September quarter 2023 and 4% for the year. This is the fastest quarterly growth in the 26-year history of the wage price index, and the fastest annual growth since Labor was last in government in 2009. While quarterly figures can be volatile, we have also seen real wages growth for the last two quarters. This government will always support Australian workers getting a pay rise, which is why we helped secure a pay rise for minimum wage workers last year, despite the scare campaign of those opposite. And it's why we supported a wage rise for aged care workers. It's why we're supporting sustainable wages growth through our productivity-enhancing investments, including in skills and training. And it's also why last year the government passed the Secure Jobs, Better Pay legislation to improve job security and to get wages moving again. Now, as we know, and as I think most Australians know, there's a big difference between the approach we have taken in government and the approach that was taken by those opposite when they were in government and had low wage growth as a deliberate design feature of their economic architecture. And we won't ever forget that. Nope. It was a deliberate design policy or deliberate decision of that former government to keep wages low. We have, in our 18 months in office, have made a number of changes, including legislation and policy changes, to make sure that we are doing what we can to ensure that Australian workers get a fair pay rise.
Thank you, Minister. The time for answering has expired. Senator Walsh, first supplementary.
Thank you, President. Thank you, Minister. We know the government's number one priority is dealing with the inflation challenge and providing cost of living relief. Can the minister outline how the Albanese Labor government's policy to support strong wage growth helps provide cost of living relief? How does this strategy work alongside the government's broader strategy to assist with cost of living pressures?
Thank you, Senator Walsh. Minister Gallagher.
Thank you, and I thank Senator Walsh for the question. The Albanese Labor government's commitment to getting wages moving again is designed to put more money in the pockets of Australian workers and help people deal with the price pressures across the economy. It's why getting wages moving again was a key part and remains a key element of our $23 billion cost of living relief plan that's been carefully calibrated and designed to take some of the edge off some of the pressures that people are under through that cost of living relief, but also not add to the inflation challenge. And in fact, what the ABS data, CPI data, shows that it actually shaved half a percentage point off inflation in the September quarter. Of course, in addition to our focus on wages, we also have important cost of living measures like tripling the bulk billing incentives, which started on the 1st of November to support 11.6 million eligible Australians to access a GP without out-of-pocket costs.
Thank you, Minister. The time for answering has expired. Senator Walsh, second supplementary.
Thank you, President. Thank you, Minister. Can the Minister explain to the Senate how the Albanese government's commitment to strong wage growth is part of its approach to responsible economic management? How are the deliberate decisions taken by the government helping to take pressure off inflation?
Thank you, Senator Walsh. Minister Gallagher.
Thank you, and I thank Senator Walsh for that supplementary. As a government, we welcome solid wages growth after our predecessors spent the best part of a decade deliberately suppressing wages.
Yep.
And today's data further demonstrates that Labor is the party of strong economic management. Yeah. We have delivered the first budget surplus in 15 years, taking the pressure off inflation, creating a more stable economic environment conducive to wages growth. We have returned an average of 87% of revenue across our first two budgets, compared to 40% under the former government. And the $40 billion in savings we've identified across both budgets has allowed us to reprioritise spending to investments that deliver that cost of living relief, secure our essential services, and boost the productivity of our economy. And again, in stark contrast to those opposite who again used robo-debt as the way of generating savings for their budget bottom
line.
Thank you, Minister. And we know the history attached to that.
Thank you, Minister. Senators, I draw to the attention of honourable senators the presence in the gallery of a delegation from the Brazil Federation Council, led by the Secretary of the Council of the Federation, Presidency of the Republic of Brazil, Mrs. Elaine Lecicio. On behalf of all senators, I wish you a warm welcome to Australia and particularly to the Senate. Senator Cash.
My question is to the Minister representing the Prime Minister, Senator Wong. Yesterday, when answering questions about the High Court case, which has led to the release of individuals from immigration detention, government ministers in both chambers repeatedly emphasised that the government resisted the application in the High Court. As you know, the Australian Human Rights Commission appeared in that case and spent taxpayer money arguing against the government and for a result which has led directly to the release of murderers, rapists and child sex offenders. Under the Legal Services directions, the long-standing requirement of governments on both sides, at least until May last year, was for the Human Rights Commission to seek approval from the Attorney-General before it makes constitutional submissions in the High Court. Did the Attorney-General give approval for the Australian Human Rights Commission to make submissions in the High Court?
Thank you, Senator Cash. Minister Wong.
First, just say tudo bem to os brasileiros. Welcome to the Senate. Can I say to Senator Cash, I was going to, I think you asked me a similar question Monday, Tuesday, I'm sorry, the days are blurring, and I did undertake those consultations with the Attorney-General and was going to add to my answer today at the end of question time, so I appreciate the opportunity. I am advised that the Australian Human Rights Commission did receive the approval of the Attorney-General to engage lawyers other than the Australian Government Solicitor, which is a technical requirement under the Legal Services Direction. I'm advised that the Commission was not required to seek approval for the substance of its submissions, which it made as an independent body, and it was abundantly clear that their submissions did not represent the views or the position of the Commonwealth of Australia.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Cash, first supplementary.
Thank you. After the orders in the case were handed down, the President of the Human Rights Commission, Professor Croucher, said this: "Those detained when they should have been released now have the vindication that their detention was unlawful and they may be entitled to restitution. Does the government now intend to pay compensation to convicted child sex offenders as the Human Rights Commission suggests?"
Thank you, Senator Cash. Minister.
Thank you, President. Well, obviously Ms Crouch is an independent officer, I think appointed under your government. The Senator would know, and as the Shadow Attorney General, the Senator would be aware, we have a separation of powers in this country. We are a constitutional democracy. The Commonwealth of Australia, under this government, argued against the proposition that the High Court has found. But the High Court has made its decision, and the government is bound to follow it, and we are doing so. I would also make the point that in relation to the other questions you asked, they are obviously hypotheticals, but what the government will do is deal with any further legal matters and consequences as a result of this decision carefully and in a considered way. And as I said, flagged earlier in my answer to Senator
Thank you,
Patterson.
Minister, the time for answering has expired. Senator Cash, second supplementary.
Thank you, Minister. In relation to your answer to my primary question, did the Attorney-General see or comment on the submissions before they were made, or was he advised of the nature of the submissions that the Australian Human Rights Commission would be making to the High Court of Australia?
Minister Wong.
As I said, the advice I have is the Australian Human Rights Commission was not required to seek approval for the substance of its submissions, which it makes as an independent body, and was abundantly clear that these did not represent the views or the position of the Commonwealth of Australia. So what we have is Senator Cash trying to put forward a proposition that an independent body—
Minister, please resume your seat. Senator Cash.
And thank you, Minister. And look, the point of order is in relation to relevance, and I am happy for the Minister to take it on notice. I do appreciate you may not have the answer. But in relation to my point, it wasn't about the permission in relation to the submissions. It was in relation to the submissions and whether the Attorney-General was able to see or comment on them or advised of the nature.
This is I think the Minister is being relevant, Senator Cash, but I'll continue to listen carefully. Thank you, Minister.
Very helpful, President and Senator Cash. What I can advise is this. One, the Human Rights Commission was granted leave by the High Court to make submissions in the NZYQ case. Two, the Commission is independent of government. One of its legislated functions is to intervene in court cases that raise human rights issues. I'm advised that neither the Attorney-General nor any other minister sign off on what those submissions say. Third, I am advised the Attorney-General approved the Commission's request for an exemption in relation to its interventions in the terms I have already indicated.
Thank you, Minister. The time for answering has expired. Senator Shoebridge.
Thank you, President. My question, without notice, is to the Minister representing the Minister for Defence. Noting that a recent Department of Defence media release stated that more than 70 Australian companies have directly shared more than $4.13 billion in global F-35 production and sustainment contracts, and that earlier this month it was revealed that Israel has been ordering F-35 spare parts from global suppliers for the F-35s it is using in the bombardment of Gaza, can the minister confirm whether or not Australia is or will be supplying F-35 parts to the State of Israel?
Thank you, Senator Shoebridge. Minister Wong.
Thank you. I would first say, given some of the events this week, I would encourage all in here not to continue to promulgate some of the disinformation on social media. There's been a lot of disinformation on social media about what Australia is doing. I'm advised that Australia has not supplied weapons to Israel since the Hamas-Israel conflict began, and I'm advised that that is the case for at least the last 5 years. I would also make the point, I trust that the senators down that end might actually do their part to push back on this disinformation, that the Australian government has not had any involvement in the conduct of the military conflict in Gaza. And given some of the misinformation on social media and the distress and anger and, frankly, some of the violent behaviour that we have seen, I would trust that those in positions of authority might exercise... I'm not surprised you take a point of order at that.
Oh, Minister Wong? Sorry. Senator Shoebridge.
My point of order is about relevance. The question was about whether or not Australia is or will be supplying F-35 parts to the State of Israel. The Minister's response is not relevant.
The Minister is being relevant. Thank you, Senator Shoebridge.
That when he is asked to consider his responsibilities to the Chamber, he takes a point of order and he's doing it again.
Minister, please resume your seat. Senator Shoebridge.
The Minister is now A, making a personal reflection, and B, clearly being not relevant to the question, which is or will Australia be supplying F-35 parts
to
the State of Israel?
Thank you, Senator Shoebridge. I will draw the Minister back to the question, and the Minister was not making a personal reflection, Minister.
Well, yeah, if we want to talk about personal reflections, we might want to go back to yesterday, but I'm happy
Minister,
to respond.
Minister, please resume your seat.
I'm happy to respond.
Minister, I have Senator Shoebridge on his feet. Senator Shoebridge.
The Minister flouted your ruling and sought
Minister.
To actually
Senator
again
Shoebridge.
Not be relevant
Senator,
and reduce
Senator
to mudslinging.
Senator Shoebridge, resume your seat. The Minister had just... Senator Watt, I am responding. The Minister had just stood again and begun her response. Minister, please continue.
Just waiting for you to stand before I speak, because I'm just waiting for you to stand before I speak because you just like to do that.
Minister Wong, I am going to draw you back to the question.
Yes.
Come on. I have indicated that I've responded to your question, I think, in the first 20 seconds, that the advice I have from Defence is that Australia has not supplied weapons to Israel since the conflict began. And I again reiterate, there's a lot of disinformation on social media, and I would invite Senator Shoebridge and his leader to perhaps make sure they don't promulgate it as
well. Thank you, Minister.
The
time for answering has expired. Senator Shoebridge, first supplementary.
Thank you, President. Given the criticism of Oxfam America and Amnesty International that the provision of 155mm artillery shells to the State of Israel for use in Gaza undermine the protection of civilians and respect for international humanitarian law, what, if any, guarantees can you give that Australian 155mm artillery shells produced by Neoa Munitions at Maryborough will not be directly exported to the State of Israel in the future or indirectly sent for use in Gaza through the US under the approved community export arrangements with the US?
Thank you, Senator Shoebridge. Minister.
I think, to be clear about the question, I have responded on the advice I have, which is that Australia has not supplied weapons to Israel.
Order.
Since the Hamas-Israel conflict began and for at least the last 5 years. I think I understand from the question that I'm asked to rule out something that may or may not happen in the future. Right, well, that's not an appropriate question for question time. I can tell you what our response is, I can tell you what the advice is, but you are trying. You are no, you know what it is? You are trying to make this a political issue in here, and I am saying to you it is utterly irresponsible, given what is happening out there in the community, for you to be backing in some of the misinformation and disinformation on social media. It is irresponsible. This party, your party, should take some control of what you are doing.
Thank you, Minister. The time for answering has expired. Senator Shoebridge, second supplementary.
Thank you, President. Minister, what response do you have to the criticism published today by the Australian Institute of International Affairs that the lack of transparency around Australia's military exports leaves the government exposed to criticisms that Australia exported weapons could be used in conflicts like Gaza, and that without change it risks Australia's credibility as a sponsor of the rules-based international order?
Thank you, Senator Shoebridge. Minister Wong.
As the senator would be aware, we have also initiated a review of the Defence Trade Controls Act 2012 to ensure it remains effective, efficient and fit for purpose. I think the senator has been advised of that previously. In relation to the point about the international rules-based order, that is an important point. That goes to who we are. And you might recall, Senator, the motion you voted against in this chamber, the bipartisan motion on this conflict that you voted against, talked about in...
Senator Shoebridge. Senator Shoebridge.
The motion that your party voted against in this chamber...
Order.
The motion that your party voted against in this chamber... reference specifically international humanitarian law, because that is an important national interest for Australia, and it is disappointed that you voted against it.
Senator Mariel Smith.
Thanks, President. My question is to the Minister representing the Minister for Defence, Senator Wong. Can the Minister update the Senate on the progress being made by the Albanese government to deliver Australia's conventionally armed nuclear-powered submarines and realise the benefits of the AUKUS partnership?
Minister Wong.
Thank you to Senator Smith from the great state of South Australia for her question about defence and defence industry jobs. And I'm pleased to say, in response to her question, that the government is making considerable progress. The Prime Minister was invited by President Biden for a state visit last month, and that visit was followed shortly by the Deputy Prime Minister, where both had successful engagements to drive our AUKUS partnership forward. Since announcing the pathway to acquire nuclear-powered submarines, the Albanese government has taken tangible actions to implement the AUKUS partnership, including the investment of $150 million in skills and workforce development in the May budget, establishing the Australian Submarine Agency on the 1st of July and commencing initial works on the submarine construction yard in our home state of South Australia, meaning mine and Senator Smith's, not everybody's. Last week in Adelaide, the Deputy Prime Minister announced further decisive steps with Premier Malinauskas. The South Australian Defence Industry Workforce and Skills Report was released, which helps identify how we can best develop the defence industry workforce in South Australia. The land exchange between the Commonwealth and South Australian governments was finalised, and the government has released an exposure draft of enabling legislation critical for establishing a seamless industrial base with our AUKUS partners. At the heart of this legislation are game-changing reforms for Australian defence industry, which should see the removal of burdensome red tape with the United Kingdom and the United States. As Deputy Prime Minister Miles has made clear, establishing a shared industrial base between Australia, the United States and the United Kingdom is a core part of AUKUS. This is the greatest industrial endeavour Australia has embarked on for decades, and it will see jobs and economic investment for generations to come.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Smith, first supplementary.
I note the Minister for Defence was in South Australia last week, where he visited the Osborne Naval Shipyard with Premier Pete Malinauskas. Can the Minister tell the Senate how South Australia, and in particular defence industry, will benefit from the recent announcements made between the Albanese government and the South Australian government?
Thank you, Senator Smith. Minister Wong.
Thank you, and I thank Senator Smith for her supplementary question. It gives me the opportunity to speak in a little more detail about the South Australian Defence Industry Workforce Skills Report and Action Plan that was released on Friday. That plan highlights that the defence industry in South Australia is forecast to grow from its current level of around 3,500 direct jobs to more than 8,500 direct jobs in the 2040s. Of course, what we need to do is act now to ensure we're able to recruit enough people with the right skills in 5 years and 10 years and beyond, and that is what the government is doing. The action plan details a strategy to grow and sustain South Australia's defence industry workforce, the workforce that is required to deliver the largest and most complex defence project Australia has undertaken. It reaffirms the government's commitment to ensuring a continuous naval shipbuilding capability. The Deputy Prime Minister also announced the formal arrangement for land transfers between the Commonwealth and Australia to enable the development of
Thank
a construction
you, Minister,
yard the and the skills and training academy.
Senator Mariel Smith, second supplementary.
Thank you, Minister. What are some of the challenges the Albanese government has confronted in delivering these important defence industry projects?
Thank you, Senator Smith. Minister.
Thank you. I might just, if I may, just finish the last point I was making in relation to the previous question, which is the development of the submarine construction yard and the Skills and Training Academy at Osborne, which also will enable 4,000 jobs expected in construction work over the years to come. But of course, there was a very different approach that was taken when those opposite were in government. We saw the legacy, a decade of chaos and dysfunction. Defence had, in fact, as the now Shadow Minister of Defence has stated, Defence had too many ministers over a 9-year period, which of course led to a squandering of a lot of opportunity. And of course, the approach of the former government was to promise the world, then walk away from it. We saw the in-and-out deal with Japan, then an in-and-out of a deal with France, and then who can forget Senator Johnston, who said he wouldn't trust the Australian Submarine Corporation to build a canoe.
Thank you, Minister.
Wouldn't
the time
trust
for
them to build a canoe.
Has expired. Senator Hanson.
Thank you very much. My question is to the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Senator Wong. With no end in sight to Australia's cost of living crisis, and with Labor's policies like record immigration and increased public spending making inflation even worse than it needs to be, the Albanese government has substantially increased our foreign aid budget to over $5 billion per year across the forward estimates and signalled more increases to come after. Is the Albanese Labor government in discussions about an increase on the $10 million of aid Australia has already provided to Gaza following the terrorist attacks in Israel?
Thank you, Senator Hanson. Minister Wong.
I think there are two parts to that question, Senator Hanson. I will seek to address both of them. The first in relation to foreign aid, and I appreciate you have a different view, but we do see development assistance as an element of our national power. It is an element of how we influence the world, and we do think there is obviously an ethical argument for, you know, if we can ensure that a child doesn't die, we can avert a death, that is a good thing for humanity. But there's also a very pragmatic and national security reason, which is we do better in a world where there is more stability and more prosperity, particularly in our region. We do better in a region that is more stable. and more prosperous. And our development assistance is about trying to ensure that. So it is about the interests of Australians. I think the question that you are asking goes to the UN Relief Works Agency. I think that might be what you're referencing in terms of Gaza. I would just make the point that this is the only organisation with a mandate to provide basic services to the Palestinian people. And obviously, you know, we all have a view about the abhorrent nature of Hamas, which regrettably retains much control in Gaza. So the only way in which we can provide assistance in a sensible way or a legitimate way to the Palestinian people in Gaza and also the West Bank is through the UN Relief Works Agency. So it's funding that was previously provided by both the Turnbull and Abbott governments. It is also funded by the United States. And Secretary Blinken has previously indicated that the US remains committing to supporting this entity.
Senator Hanson, first supplementary.
It was revealed on the weekend that Australians have been donating thousands of dollars to a charity funded by Australian Palestine Advocacy Network President and Terror Apologist Nasser Mashini, which is funneling the money to an aid organisation in Gaza accused of links to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine terrorist group. Minister, what assurances do you offer the Australian people that taxpayer dollars are not supporting terrorists?
Thank you, Senator Hanson. Minister Wong.
I will I'll confirm this, Senator, but I think when I looked at this after the story broke, that is not an entity that the Australian government funds. The funding that we provide is through the UN Relief Work Agency. I think that's the R. I'm sorry, I'm quite tired. UNRWA. and the entity that you describe is funded by private donation. That is my recollection, and if I'm incorrect, I will come back to the chamber and clarify that with you.
Senator Hanson, second supplementary.
The Albanese government is increasing foreign aid while the Australian people are experiencing a lower standard of living, declining access to healthcare, massive energy cost increases, rising crime and rising interest rates. When is the Albanese government going to stop putting the needs of foreign countries first before Australia, when so many Australians are struggling and suffering?
Thank you, Senator Hanson. Minister Wong.
I'd make 2 points, Senator. As you would know, the government is very focused on the cost of living challenges that Australians are facing. That is why we saw some $23 billion worth of cost of living measures in the budget. That is why we are seeking to get wages moving again. And as Senator Gallagher said in her first answer, that we are very pleased to see the figures released today shows that wages are at a much better level than they have been for many years. Obviously there's a lot more work to do, and there, you know, we know what inflation is how inflation is a challenge within the economy and for families. But this is what we are focused on. How do we ensure that wages get moving and we deal with cost of living matters? In relation to development assistance, I'd refer you to the strategic argument I put in my first answer.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Birmingham.
Thanks, President. President, my question is to the Minister representing the Prime Minister, Senator Wong. As the minister has acknowledged today, the 83, as I understand it now, individuals released following last week's High Court decision are assured by the government, subject to, and I quote, a range of strict mandatory visa conditions. Such conditions include restricting types of employment, requiring regular reporting to authorities, and requiring released detainees to report their personal detail, including their social media profiles, end quote. My colleague Senator Patterson has asked on multiple occasions, what are the specific consequences if one of these 83 individuals released from immigration detention violates these visa conditions? Is it the fact that the penalty for breaching a visa condition in detention is detention pending removal, which the High Court has ruled unconstitutional for this cohort? Is that the reality that Senator Patterson has identified and the government has failed so far to address?
Thank you, Senator Birmingham. Minister Wong.
It is the case that the legislative framework that you operated under did not contemplate a constitutional view of detention that has been found by the High Court. So it is the case that the arrangements, the legislative or regulatory framework associated with such persons will need to be amended. The government is working through that. And as I said, the government intends to introduce legislation shortly to further respond to the decision of the High Court. We look forward to the opposition assisting with passage of that legislation as soon as is possible.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Birmingham, first supplementary.
Thanks, President. First supplementary question. The Coalition, since the ruling was handed down last week, has repeatedly suggested the need for the government to legislate remedies as a result of the ruling. But as recently as this morning, the Minister for Home Affairs described calls to legislate as, quote, garbage and, quote, categorically false. Was Minister Neal correct in her assertions then, or when was the decision taken by government to bring legislation to the parliament as the opposition has been suggesting?
Senator Birmingham, the time has expired. Minister Wong.
First, I don't think that is an accurate reflection of what Ms O'Neill said. Second, the government has been very promptly seeking to deal with a decision that does, as Senator Patterson himself indicated, overturn a 20-year precedent. And as a consequence, there are a set of changes that are likely to be required in relation to the framework that was your framework, as well as the framework under which we have been operating and which the High Court has now said is unconstitutional in this regard. I would note, and I do sound a note of caution, that as yet the High Court has not handed down decision, its reasons for decision. No doubt those will need to be studied as well when that does occur, because this does represent a very substantial change in position from what was understood by your government.
Thank you, Minister. The time for answering has expired. Senator Birmingham, second supplementary.
Thank you. First, the government said it would await those reasons for decision before releasing any other individuals. Then the government said that it was not pursuing legislative remedies and described them as garbage, but now is doing so. The government said that individuals were subject to visas upon release. Now apparently it's a technicality that they're occurring after release. How does this provide confidence to Australians that the government is comprehensively handling this?
Minister Wong.
There's a lot of assertions in there, and the great majority of them are simply untrue. I know that the opposition want to jump on this and play a lot of politics with it. I know that it's actually got it. You know, they're much more interested in talking about this than cost of living. Senator Cash, you know, really loves to suggest that she's the only person who cares about keeping Australians safe. Actually, we do too. We all do. We all do. We
Senator
all do.
Cash.
You know,
Senator
you are Cash. Not. You are not the only person in the universe who cares
Senator
about national
Cash.
Security. We do. And what I know that you want, you are salivating at
Senator
playing a bit
Cash.
Of domestic politics in this, Senator Cash. This is a decision, as Senator Patterson rightly pointed out, overturns a 20-year precedent, and it's going
Thank
to
you,
require
Minister, the time for
legislative
has
or regulatory.
Expired. Senator Hanson-Young.
Thank you, President. My question is to the Minister for Emergency Management and the Minister representing the Minister for Communications, Senator Watt. Already this year, we have seen bushfires raging across Queensland, New South Wales, the Northern Territory, Western Australia and Tasmania. We have seen people die already. We have seen homes destroyed, and it's only mid-November. During emergencies, Reliable and timely information is essential to protect both people and property. Will the government boost ABC funding to ensure that the ABC, our national emergency broadcaster, can continue to keep Australians informed and safe?
Thank you, Senator Hanson-Young. Minister Watt.
Thank you, President, and thank you, Senator Hanson-Young. As I've pointed out repeatedly in this chamber, the Albanese government are strong supporters of the ABC and SBS, for that matter, as our national public broadcasters. And we were very proud of the fact that in, I think it was our first budget, we reversed a substantial portion of the funding cuts that had been imposed on the ABC by the former coalition government, who we know are no friends of public broadcasting or the ABC. I absolutely recognise the vital role of the ABC when it comes to emergency broadcasting. I've personally relied on it, and I've certainly met a lot of Australians who have. And of course, one of the reasons that people become reliant on ABC emergency broadcasts is because, as you point out, there are occasions that our communications networks do fail because of the impact of disasters. And literally the way that people stay aware of emergency situations is by having a portable radio, battery-powered, not reliant on the electricity network to receive those emergency warnings. So you would be aware, I'm sure, Senator Hanson-Young, that in addition to the restoring the funding cuts from the former coalition government, this government has taken a number of steps to lock in certainty around future ABC funding, in particular locking in 5-year funding terms of increased funding, so that the ABC, whether it be the emergency broadcasting section or any other, is not subject to the whims of the government of the day and is not subject to, you know, the risk of political interference through fear of losing their funding. That will assist the emergency broadcasting role of the ABC, in addition to the many other important roles that the ABC plays. We're of course also conducting a review into options for strengthening the independence of the ABC to safeguard against further arbitrary funding cuts
that we might perhaps see from a future coalition government.
Thank you, President. The ABC does not receive extra funding to do this vital work of keeping Australians informed and safe. We know that we can't rely on telecommunications such as Optus. We've seen that over the last week. Next month, your government is going to be handing down MyEFO. Ahead of this horror summer, will you commit to extra funding to keep Australians safe and informed and help
you,
the ABC do their job?
The time for asking has expired. Minister Watt.
Well, Senator Hanson-Young, I know that Senator Gallagher would have a lot to say if I were to reveal my EFO commitments before the day itself. But as I say, the actions that we have already taken in restoring the former government's cuts to the ABC and in locking in that guaranteed funding for 5 years for the ABC, obviously that will partially benefit the ABC's emergency broadcasting section in addition to its other services. But this is not the only thing that this government is doing to improve our preparedness for this disaster season. I've already said that this year we will have the largest ever fleet of aerial firefighting planes that we've ever had in this country, around 500. We've obviously taken steps through our Disaster Ready Fund, and even in communications we're well on the way to delivering a much better and faster messaging service for people in emergency situations as well.
Senator Hanson-Young, second supplementary.
Thank you, President. At Senate estimates only a couple of weeks ago, the ABC revealed that they have received no extra funding to help them do this vital work. It's essential. It's important. The ABC does it out of the rest of their budget. I urge you to consider funding the ABC properly and ensuring that Australians have access to this information at their time when it is most needed.
Thank you, Senator Hanson-Young. Minister Watt.
Thank you, Senator Hanson-Young. Well, again, you would be familiar with the fact that the ABC does operate independently of government, and we don't direct them as to how they should use the funding that's provided by government. It's a matter for ABC management to decide whether they dedicate the extra funding that we've provided to emergency broadcasting or to their other activities. I will note, though, and Senator McAllister has drawn my attention to a speech that the Minister for Communications gave to the ABC Friends of Victoria, I think in November last year, in which she talked about the reinstatement of funding that had been cut from the coalition. And what Minister Rowland said that was on budget night in October last year, she was pleased to see the ABC welcome the extra funding commitment, issuing a statement that said the increase in funding will mean greater capacity to deliver emergency broadcasting services to provide crucial information. So it would appear that, in the ABC's own words, they have received funding that will assist them with that that service.
Thank you, Senator Watt. Senator Stirl.
Thank you, President. My question is for the Minister representing the Minister for Resources, Senator Watt. I refer to the announcement by the Prime Minister during his recent visit to the United States that the Albanese government will deliver a $2 billion expansion in critical minerals financing, which will solidify Australia's position as a world-leading provider, help the transition to net zero, boost the economy and support more jobs and opportunities for Australians. Noting this expansion of the critical minerals facilities takes the government's value-adding investments in Australian resources to $6 billion, can the minister please explain to the Senate how investing in critical minerals financing will bolster the sector in Australia, resulting in technology, skills, jobs and economic benefits for Australians?
Thank you, Senator Stirl. Minister Watt.
Thank you, President. Thank you, Senator Stirl, who I know as a Western Australian senator is very excited about the opportunities around critical minerals, as might I say are Senator Green and Senator Chisholm, being from Queensland, where there's lots of opportunities too, and no doubt other states as well. Before answering Senator Stirl's question, though, I do want to start by offering my sincere condolences to everyone affected by the tragic accident at Alcoa's refinery in Pinjarra, Western Australia, obviously also in the resources sector. Every worker has the right to a safe workplace, and every worker deserves to arrive home to their family after a day's work. So we do pass on our condolences to the family and friends of those workers. President, the workers are central to our resources sector, and the Albanese government is committed to developing Australia's critical mineral sector. This sector is critical to the transition to net zero, and we're making investments to support that transition to drive economic growth and create high-value jobs. As the Prime Minister recently announced in the United States, we've doubled the finance available under the Critical Minerals Facility, which supports the projects required to secure the minerals of the future. And I note, Senator Stirl, there's a lot of people who've had a bit to say about the Prime Minister's international engagement, but this is an example of why it is important to have international engagement, because it delivers these types of investments that create jobs for Australians. This facility is aligned with our critical minerals strategy, which clearly outlines our vision for Australia to be the supplier of choice of critical minerals to the world. Not only will we export our ores, but we will provide more processed and refined material to capture more value here in Australia. The Albanese government is investing in our ability to build, refine and manufacture things here in Australia. We want to have a future built in Australia. Our resources sector and our manufacturing sector will work hand in hand to deliver the jobs of the future. Research from the University of California, Berkeley, has found that every skilled job created in advanced manufacturing creates 2.5 jobs in the local economy.
Thank you, Minister. The time for answering has expired. Senator Searle, first supplementary.
Noting a sustainable and reliable supply of critical minerals is vital to supporting the Australian and United States manufacturing sectors, and Australia is ideally positioned to provide responsibly produced and processed critical minerals to fulfil this demand, can the minister please outline what other measures the Albanese government is delivering to ensure our critical minerals industry can grow and thrive into the future?
Thank you, Senator Stirl. Minister Watt.
Thank you, Senator Stirl. I certainly can. Earlier this year, Minister Madeleine King announced close to $50 million in grants under the Critical Minerals Development Program. And you might be interested to know, Senator Stirl, that those grants included $5.9 million to the Browns Range Heavy Rare Earths Project in Halls Creek in your state of Western Australia, creating 54 new jobs, and $6.25 million to the Magnesium Refinery Pilot Plant in Collie, Western Australia, creating 46 new jobs. But beyond that, we've also committed $57.1 million for international partnerships in critical minerals. The Minister for Resources has been working with counterparts in India, the United States and across Europe to progress our shared interests in building strong and diverse global supply chains in critical minerals. We also know all the levers to build our industry can't just sit in one portfolio, and that's why Minister Husic is working with the newly appointed National Reconstruction Fund Board to deliver the $1 billion earmarked to support value-adding in resources.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Searle, second supplementary.
Thank you, President. Recognising the expanded critical minerals facility supports the Australian Government's Critical Minerals Strategy 2023 to 2030, why has the Albanese Government taken this approach in preference to other proposed approaches?
Minister Watt.
Thank you, President. Thank you, Senator Searle. The Albanese Government's Critical Minerals Strategy sets a plan and a framework to grow Australia's critical minerals industry. And the $2 billion expansion to the critical minerals facility will support projects that align with that strategy. Now, I do remember a lot of announcements by the former government when it came to critical minerals, but like with so many other features of their government, there were lots of announcements and no real delivery, and the same when it comes to critical minerals. And to pick just one way in which our approach to lift differs, apart from announcements that actually deliver, we are a government that is committed to consultation with industry.
Senator McDonald.
But consultation with industry didn't seem to be a priority of the Liberals and the Nationals, just like delivery didn't seem to be a priority. They delivered two critical mineral strategies and a critical minerals list, lots of big announcements, hardly delivered anything and hardly consulted anyone. This government is committed to acting with transparency and integrity, and unlike the Liberals and Nationals, we will actually deliver.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Davey.
Thank you. My question is to the Minister representing the Minister for the Environment and Water, Senator Wong. And I want to acknowledge there are food processors and producers in the House today for the Taste of the Basin event tonight. Minister, dairy farmer Malcolm Holm told a recent Senate inquiry that if he sold his water and converted his farm to dry land, he would immediately lay off 12 staff that he currently employs. Minister, can you tell the Chamber what modelling the government has done to benchmark the impact of its water buyback policies on regional communities to ensure it does not result in job losses and drive up the cost of living for everyday Australian households?
Thank you, Senator Davey. Minister Wong.
Thank you, President, and thank you to Senator Davey. And I also briefly dropped in at an event yesterday in which you did too, so you would know that there were also farmers and agricultural producers, as well as environmentalists and community people who were there, who are supportive of the Murray-Darling Plan. Mm-hmm. And I would also make the point, if I can, a shout out to Henry Jones' wife, Gloria, who was there cooking the mullet. And Henry, of course, is now Coorong mullet, I should say. And Henry was a fisherman who was a strong advocate for reform of the basin, a very decent man who spent a lot of his life working on these issues. And what
Minister, please resume your seat. Senator Davey.
Well, I appreciate the Minister outlining what happened yesterday, and it was delicious mullet. I would like to bring her to the point of the question. She's got a minute left to tell us what modelling the government has done.
Thank you. And the Minister is being relevant. We are talking about the Murray-Darling Basin, as I understand it. Minister, please continue.
Thank you. How is this relevant? I know you're from WA, aren't you? But actually, this is about the plan, the Murray-Darling Basin plan. That's how it's relevant. And the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, I know that the National Party doesn't support it. I know that they say they really don't want to support it.
Order.
And they won't concede, or they won't recognise the enormous amount of environmental and economic work that was done for the plan, and that your government adopted the plan. But the problem was you adopted it so that Senator Birmingham and Senator Rustin could go to Adelaide and say, we've got the Murray-Darling Basin Plan, but you just made sure you never did anything. You made sure you never did anything, and so you actually didn't deliver almost any water. And so the great political solution for the coalition and their enormous division on water policy is you adopt a plan, but you don't actually do anything about it. Well, that isn't the approach we'll be taking, because we recognise this, like Malcolm Turnbull did. Like Malcolm Turnbull did, you have to have reform in the Murray-Darling Basin.
Senator Davey, first supplementary.
No modelling.
At the same hearings, Chairman of SPC Global, Mr Hussein Hani Rifai, spoke of the risk to that company from their ability to compete against cheap imports. Minister, will you guarantee that none of the businesses, farms or manufacturers that Australia relies on for food and fibre will go bust or lay off workers as a result of Labor's buyback policies? Have you done the modelling?
Thank you, Senator Davey. Minister Wong.
Again, the Murray-Darling Basin plan was subject to an enormous amount of research and consultation, and the senator knows that. The senator knows that. The reality is, though, none of that will change the mind of the National Party. But I am interested, and just to remind you, Senator, of some of your colleagues, Senator Rustin, who said, "We will not stop trying. We are committed to the delivery of the plan." Oh. Senator Birmingham, "The government stands resolute in its support of the Murray-Darling Basin plan in full and on time." And Mr Stevens and Senator McLaughlin said they supported buybacks. Said they supported buybacks. Mr Stevens and Senator McLaughlin said they supported buybacks. So what is your policy? What is your policy? I mean, government, we know what it is. What is it in opposition? What would, what is the Dutton opposition's policy on the Murray-Darling Basin?
Senator Davies, second supplementary.
The Mayor of Ballonshire in Queensland, Sam O'Toole, spoke of the impact of the last round of untargeted open slather buybacks. Minister, why is the government removing the Labor Party's social and economic impact test from the plan for water recovery that will impact communities like Ballonshire, which are so reliant on agriculture?
Thank you, Senator Davey. Minister Wong.
Well, look, the government is aware that this is a difficult issue. We understand, and I understand personally. I've been the water minister, and I've travelled a lot through the basin, and I understand that this is a really challenging issue for many communities. But as I said to them, I said, I'm not going to be one of those politicians that turn up and pretend that things can go on as they were, because they can't. And I know that Senator Joyce and the National Party want to keep telling people that nothing needs to change. But we know that is not the case. So the choice is you're either upfront with people about what needs to happen, or you keep pretending to them that nothing needs to change, and we know that's not true. Now, the government will put in place appropriate structural adjustment. The government will put in place appropriate consultation, but I do say to you again, let's not pretend after so many years that things can go on without any change.
Thank you, Minister. The time for answering has expired. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, President. My question is to the Minister for Women, Senator Gallagher. Improving women's economic equality is rightly a priority of the Albanese government. The recent employment white paper notes this will require focus on ways we can better value and share care to reduce workforce gender segregation. The white paper also notes that Australia has one of the highest rates of women working part-time in the OECD, and analysis released by the Workplace Gender Equality Agency today backs this finding, highlighting our challenges in workforce participation. So, can the minister please outline the government's understanding of women's experiences of part-time work in Australia and what this means for their economic security?
Thank you, Senator Pratt. Minister Gallagher.
Thank you, President. I thank Senator Pratt for the question. And as she points out in her question to me, WGEA has today released important new data indicating how part-time work is affecting women's economic equality. WGEA's annual employer census showed that women were more likely to work part-time than men. 30% of women in the survey worked part-time compared to 11% of men. The WGEA data also confirmed that 7% of management roles were held by part-time employees. WGEA said that the data pointed to what it called a part-time promotion cliff for women. Australia has one of the highest rates of women in part-time employment in the OECD, behind the Netherlands, Switzerland and Japan. A key driver of these different patterns of employment is the significant and long-term adjustments women typically make to their paid employment following the arrival of children, while at the same time men's employment patterns remain largely unchanged. Working part-time means women's incomes are lower and they retire with less super and savings. This contributes to the gender earnings gap, which still sits at 13% nationally. This data demonstrates that we have a long way to go to achieve economic equality for women, with women still taking on the majority of care roles in households, which of course has flow-on impacts on their workforce participation. There must be greater recognition that a rich career offers often includes times of working differently, including to care for children, and this should not be incompatible with advancement, recognition, or working in senior roles. Families should be supported to share care more equally, enabling both parents to have time to care for and connect with their children. And it's why our investment in childcare and our parental leave reforms, which provide each parent 4 weeks of reserved leave from July 2026, when the full scheme is implemented, to encourage that shared care.
Senator Pratt, first supplementary.
In light of the Wajir data, could the minister please tell the Senate what action the Albanese government is taking to close the gender pay gap and support overall workforce participation, safety at work and the economic independence of Australian women?
Thank you, Senator Pratt. Minister.
Thank you, and I thank Senator Pratt for the supplementary. There are some reforms that we've introduced to the publish the gender pay gaps of employers with 100 or more workers, which is a key reform to drive transparency and action towards closing the gender pay gap, will be, you know, key, I think, to shining a bit of light on what's going on. And I think many businesses I've spoken to are supportive of that reform. Workforce gender segregation contributes to the gender pay gap, as men continue to dominate in industries and occupations with higher earnings and women with lower earnings, also reflecting the historical undervaluing of feminised jobs. So we need to come at this through a variety of ways, including through the Australian Skills Guarantee, through the reforms under the gender pay gap reporting, through our support for proper wages in aged care and proper funding and indexation for community organisations, another area where workers are predominantly women.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Pratt, second supplement.
Thank you. Can the Minister outline how the government is working to address the challenges facing women's employment and economic participation? And how will this approach help tackle long-term inequality and improve outcomes for Australian women?
Thank you, Senator Pratt. Minister.
Thank you very much. Well, the government has made addressing women's economic equality central to our decision-making in government. So you have seen the reforms that we've introduced through our measures around investments in childcare, also those reforms I talked about in gender pay gap reporting. We've got measures across the education and training sector through the Skills Guarantee. We've addressed some of the big issues around parenting payments single and programs like Parents Next. I've got the Women's Economic Equality Task Force report, which will feed into the National Gender Equality Strategy next year. And all of that is pulling into the direction of wanting to address some of these structural barriers to women's economic independence and economic equality and make sure that women get a fair crack at the opportunities going forward.
Thank you, Minister. Senator Wong.
Further questions be placed on notice.